Hi, Greg Perry, the historic preservationist. Welcome to season 3, episode 17. Moving into an episode about somewhat the beginning of timekeeping, and it's going to incorporate a little bit of what they call the father of timekeeping, Thomas Tompion. So let's look at some background of where we were in the 16th century. Before timekeeping really took off. So let's get started here. So it is quite difficult to form a picture of what was taking place in the handicrafts of clock and watchmaking in England during the 16th century. For so little evidence remains to decide whether, for instance, the elaborate clocks described in Henry VIII's wardrobe inventory and the richly ornamented and jeweled watches listed in that of Queen Elizabeth were brought abroad or made in England. And if made in England, then the question arises whether they were the work of alien or English craftsmen. So what do we know is that the crude iron clocks, which by the 16th century were fitted into most church towers throughout the country, were made by English blacksmiths, and that these craftsmen must have been responsible for the smaller scale domestic clocks, which were occasionally found in 16th century inventories, and described as a clock and a bell, or a clock with a frame. The mechanism and the frame of this blacksmith's made chamber clock were, however, of the greatest simplicity compared to that of the clocks owned by, say, Henry VIII. So, remember, the blacksmith's clocks were absolutely at the beginning, and they were, basically used as tower clocks. So, but the making of clocks, which showed the changes of the moon, the ebb and flow of the tides, the days of the year, the position of the planets in the zodiac, which were encased in copper and gilt frames, decorated with engraving and enameling, and sometimes set in glass cases, was far beyond the skill of the blacksmith. Clocks as elaborate as these must, therefore, have come within the province of another craft, the technique of which displayed greater precision and the workmanship of higher order. Such a craft can easily be identified with that of the locksmith. On the continent, those locksmiths who concentrated on clockmaking became, in the course of time, specialists in this branch, and were called, inevitably, clockmakers. Later, the finer workmanship of watchmaking produced a further division in this craft. The work of locksmiths in England never achieved the standard of continental locksmiths. Therefore, clockmaking in the island remained chiefly in the hands of the blacksmiths. It was not until the early part of the 17th century that the iron clocks of the English blacksmiths began to take on those finer qualities which distinguished the work of continental clockmakers. To a great extent, this was due to the foreign craftsmen who came to live and work there. Their greater skill and new techniques in clock and watchmaking soon spread throughout the countryside, chiefly through the English apprentices who, having served their term and inspired by the knowledge and skill they had acquired elsewhere, started on their own account. We know of only a few English clock and watchmakers of the 16th century. Nicholas Ursall can be considered as one of them, for although of French birth, he worked in London until about 1531 and was the clockmaker to Edward VI. Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth in 1556. And in 1556, he gave Queen Mary a new gift of a fair clock in a case covered with a black velvet. So when he died in 1577, another Nicholas Ursault clock, who was presumably his son, became clockmaker to Elizabeth, and he died in 1590. The little knowledge that we have been able to gather from written records and a few extant clocks and watches of the Elizabethan school of clock and watchmaking indicates that the English product was far behind the world, both in quality and ingenuity of design. The best work was done by the French and German masters. So it should be understood that Elizabethan clocks, both weight and spring driven, were exceedingly poor timekeepers. They were so erratic, and they needed to be corrected daily with the sundial, sometimes off a half hour to an hour in 24 hours. And watches were even less reliable. In the days of Elizabeth and James I, a watch was a costly article, and generally speaking, more expensive than a clock. Owing to its smaller size, it took greater skill, and this was required in its making. It was usually set in an elaborate case, either of silver, gold, or fire-gilt brass, and pierced, engraved, or even chased. Cases of crystal, studded with jewels, or enamel were also used. The high cost of a watch confirmed its ownership to the wealthy members of the Elizabethan society. The period from 1600 to 1660 was an all-important one for the English craft of clock and watchmaking. It saw the English school established, and it was the time when English clocks and watches first acquired an individual national character so they could be distinguished from contemporary German and French examples. The first clock to adopt an English form was a variation of the continental brass weight-driven wall clock, called today a lantern clock. In inventories, it is sometimes described as a brass clock, unlike the earlier clocks made entirely of iron and with their dials painted. The post of the frame, the sides of the doors, and the dial were all brass, and the movement had both brass and iron on its wheelwork. Clocks of this type were made with an hour hand only. It is rare to find an example which has an original minute hand. The smallest division on the dial was a quarter of an hour, for the poor timekeeping of these chamber clocks did not even justify a closer reading, apart from which our ancestors of the 17th century did not consider a finer division of an hour necessary for the regulation of their daily affairs. They just didn't need it. Harrison gives us some information on the point. For him, the smallest practical unit of time was 7.5 minutes. For example, half a quarter, a division which would be difficult to show on a clock with only one hand. The spring table clock, with a round, square, or even hexagonal case, designed so that the dial faced upwards, does not appear to have taken on the English form. For the smaller number of examples which are inscribed with names of English makers, have little to distinguish them from contemporary continental clocks. So it could be that they actually acquired the continental clocks and put their own names on them. That's a very distinct possibility. But English watches dating from the early years of the 17th century have few distinguishing features. A band of engraving, for example, around the back plate is one of them. But in the second quarter of the century, a type of plain, egg-shaped watch with a small, circular dial, generally in a silver case, with little, if any, engraved decoration, came into vogue. This type of watch is more characteristically English than any of the earlier designs. In the first quarter of the 17th century, the little band of London clockmakers continued to increase in numbers through the arrival of clockmakers, strangers from beyond the seas, as they were called. The competition was, of course, unwelcomed, and jealousy and dissension rose among the London and the foreign craftsmen, culminating in 16 of the former, who were all said to be householders in the city, presenting in 1622 a petition to the king. The grievances of the clockmakers, which were citizens and inhabitants of London, is the conventional title of their complaint, and the list of 24 names, mostly French. So one of the major accusations against the strangers was that they went to the chambers of gentlemen and noblemen to sell their products, which were of inferior work, though the appeal of the outward shrew of the cases, which commonly is beautiful. But in other words, the petitioners, not being able to compete with the finely engraved and chaste cases of the foreign craftsmen, the beauty of which they had to admit, were forced to pin their complaint on to the supposed inferior workmanship of their own mechanism. So the foreigners coming in were doing well superior work to these people filing a complaint, the clockmakers, and they wanted to get rid of them. So very, very interesting. So nothing appears to have happened in response to this petition. And in 1627, a further petition against the intrusion of clockmaking strangers was again presented. This time it came from the blacksmith's company, to which a number of the London clockmakers belonged. They objected to a proposed grant of letters, patent, which would allow French clockmakers the free use of their trade of clockmaking within the city of London only. Apparently, this petition, too, failed in its objection, for we know nothing of what happened any further about it. The difficulties of the London clockmakers arose from the fact that they were without a charter. They had no union, basically. But when, in the past, there were blacksmiths, clockmakers, they belonged, for the most part, to the blacksmith's company. But now they were just a loose body of craftsmen following the same trade, and unaffiliated to any of the London, or present, let's put it that way, present then, London corporations. When we talk about corporations, we talk about a union, so to speak, or a guild. They were thus deprived of the right to search for and seize insufficient and deceitful work, which would enable them to enter the workshops of their French competitors, and generally keep control, or keep them under control. Their aim was to divide and rule, for they could not exclude the Frenchmen. Accordingly, in 1628, the English clockmakers in London asked the blacksmiths if they would allow them to come into their company or guild. The answer was a resounding no. This day, records the minute book of the blacksmiths, the clockmakers brought to their reply, which being read and considered of this company, they disliked. The following year, the London clockmakers decided to try to establish a new company of their own, and accordingly applied for a charter of incorporation. They raised among themselves the necessary funds and sent in a petition to the authorities in the names of two of their members, François Forman and Ricard Morgan. The petition was referred to the court of aldermen of the city for advice on whether the granting of a charter would be legal to any other corporations or governments already established. So in 1631, a charter of incorporation was granted, satisfying the long-felt need of the London clockmakers for official recognition. Thenceforth, they were known as the Master Wardens and Fellowship of the Art and Mystery of Clockmaking of the City of London. It is clear from the charter and the bylaws of the new company that its members were intent upon suppressing or at least controlling the trade in imported clocks and watches, which previously had been such a menace to the handicraft itself, or so the craftsmen from London thought. Nobody was allowed to offer for sale any foreign imported clocks, watches, labrums, boxes, sundials, or cases for watches, clocks, which were belonging to the art and mystery of the clockmaking, upon pain of forfeiture until these goods were first viewed and approved of at the company's hall or the guild's hall. So, if found up to standard, they received a mark to testify the allowance of the company, but if these foreigners' products were found faulty or deceitfully wrought, they were seized and either defaced or ordered to be amended and made perfect. Another regulation was so designed as to make it more difficult for the foreign clockmaker to even set up in London. No alien or stranger whatsoever, born out of the dominations, not naturalized or denied, which meant saving such as already allowed by the Londoners, shall attempt to work in any place whatsoever within the limits and circuits of our royal grant, either privileged or not privileged, saving only to or with an allowed and professed clockmaker. So, with their own company and the protection it afforded, the London clockmakers, both English and alien, became at last united, and the craft of clock and watchmaking in England fully established. In the first half of the 17th century, clockmaking in the provincial centers also improved. From making only iron, church, and chamber clocks, provincial craftsmanship now became sufficiently skilled to execute even watchwork. It was quite impressive. So a great advance was made in the art of clockmaking when Christian Huygens, the Dutch mathematical genius, discovered between 1655 and 56 the way of using a pendulum as a clock regulator. Huygens assigned his invention to a master clockmaker at The Hague, at the Salmon Kloster. And by 1657, the new clocks were into production. Their success was immediate, for the substitution of his pendulum for a balance, which was the earlier methodology of regulation, changed the clock from a poor and indifferent timekeeper to one that was more or less reliable. Reports about the Dutch pendulum clock quickly came to England, and before the year was out, John Fromentiel, one of the family of London clockmakers of Dutch descent, went to Holland and entered Coster's service to learn the pendulum. In 1658, the firm of Fromentiel was advertising in London the sale of the new pendulum-style clocks. The appearance of the pendulum clock in London must have caused a boom in the clockmaker's trade. For all who could afford it and wanted to replace their old balance wheel clock with a new pendule, as Huygens' invention was called, and those who could not, had the balance wheel alone exchanged for the new regulator. And we daily see the shops of clockmakers and watchmakers more and more furnished with those useful instruments, pendulum clocks, which were brought into request but just a few years ago, and this was taken from one of the clockmaker's diaries. The fertile reign of Charles II saw the establishment of English horology. It now became a subject of discussion and investigation among the learned members of the newly founded Royal Society. English clockmakers, no longer blacksmiths, blindly copying just continental clockwork, were now following their own invention and producing clocks and watches on the English lines. Not only did this apply to the mechanism, but also to the craftsmanship, the refinement of which took on a national character. Clock and watch cases also developed an English style of design. So that finishes up our one of two-part series about the beginning of clockmaking. It's really the part and parcel, the beginning of really solid timekeeping. It was overnight that with Huygens' invention, he also, I believe, worked with the English mathematician Robert Hooke to develop a lot of the principles of this. You know, and we must also go back probably to the 14th, when Galileo was doing a lot of his postulates in Italy, and he saw a chandelier in the Leaning Tower of Pisa going back and forth. He had written and actually designed a clock pendulum, and it was never put into practice. So really, Huygens came and picked up on this and took it further down the line. Kind of limited theory, but Galileo postulated this theory of some kind form of regulation of the time of the chandelier going back and forth. What caused it to go back and forth, I do not know, if someone hit it or we had an earthquake, but nevertheless, the beginning of really accurate timekeeping. And simultaneously with these foreigners coming in with higher quality workmanship from France and Germany, it put the English on notice that they better get their act together. And I think in the end, they thought it was better to incorporate them into their system because it would up the game for everybody. And that's exactly what they did. And hence the guild system was set up, and the guild system became a real quality union for everybody, even the people that purchase clocks and watches, because you know it was consistent with a clock or watch made in London or Liverpool or Northamptonshire, you know, the quality and the consistency was there. And parts could be interchanged at any of these locations. So the guild system said, okay, the third wheel in the going train had to be this diameter and had to have this type of pitch on the teeth and this many teeth. And so it could be exchanged, but what it created was, it created a limited type of cottage mass production, almost, in a way. And so it helped the clockmakers, it helped the watchmakers, and it actually helped the public and the English putting out a much more quality product in the end. So just fascinating stuff to, you know, to see this scientific revolution occurring. And, you know, and then this kind of got held back and stopped by the Great Fire of London. Then there was the plague and the saints almost simultaneously. And that really is a reason why we don't see a lot of the flat-top marquetry-decorated clocks, because so many of them just burned up and incinerated in London during the fire. And it actually, the fire actually started on Pudding Lane, you know, just down around from the clock and watchmaker's enclave. But let's don't get too far ahead of herself. We'll pick this up at a later time. But Greg Perry, the historic preservationist, signing out. Thanks for listening.